This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's continue our conversation on design and inclusion. More and more jurisdictions are passing accessibility legislation, and with that comes the development of accessibility standards. Several cities and municipalities are establishing what accessibility should look like in the built environment. And accessibility specialist Thea Curdy is here to offer her perspective. Thea is also the Vice President of Designable Environments. Hey, good morning, Thea. Great to chat with you once again.
Good morning, Dave. I'm all dressed up in my Santa Helper's outfit.
The holiday season is upon us through and through. So, Thea, we can get into some of the specific municipal standards in just a moment, but let's start with some context. What is an accessibility standard?
Well, it's a really good place to start because it's kind of a complicated question. There are actually two different types of standards, and I'm using air quotes here. The first is, as you mentioned, is a part of legislation. And once those standards are enacted, they're not optional. They are a part of the law. And we currently see these acts in, for example, Ontario with the Accessibility Frontiers and Disabilities Act, the Accessible Manitoba Act, and they're under development under the Accessible Canada Act, the Nova Scotia Accessible Act, and the future Accessible British Columbia Act. The second type of standard that we see is not really legislation. In fact, it's not legislation. They're actually more guidelines, which are created by organizations like the CNIB, like Deafblind Ontario, like Toronto Community Housing, and many others, or corporations like the Bank of Montreal. But as you mentioned, municipalities, which are then can mandate how these standards or guidelines are used in the creation of their developments. So municipalities is usually mandated. In other places, they are simply guidelines. And I'll be providing resources throughout social media to help people find those.
You always do. We always appreciate that value added you give us on social media. So Thea, again, I'm sort of tiptoeing our way to the municipal side of this, but I want to stay federal and big picture for one more question. We do have a national building code in Canada. Does that offer any guidance on accessibility standards?
Well, it does offer some guidance on accessibility standards, but not the type of guidance we actually need. Our current National Building Code does have a small section. So instead of thinking about accessibility is integral to successful design, which should mean that the building code throughout the building code would include accessibility as just a part of design. But instead, it's still written in the old way of thinking where there's a small section devoted to a barrier-free design sort of mentality. And unfortunately, it doesn't fully address inclusion for disabled Canadians or help to create actually accessible buildings and spaces. Provinces have had the choice to adopt the National Building Code as is or amend it. So, for example, British Columbia, Nova Scotia, and Ontario have amended the National Building Code to create their own provincial standards. That may be going away sometime in the future. But for now, Ontario has probably made the most additions to the accessibility requirements, including changes that happened in the 2020 code and now coming in January in 2022. And again, I can provide a link to that. But accessibility standards become necessary because the requirements to actually get to real accessibility and evidence-based design are just not included in the legislation right now.
So along those lines, when you've got different jurisdictions creating their own standards, from a human rights perspective, does that create a little bit of a jurisdictional hodgepodge?
Well, not just a jurisdictional hodgepodge, but an actual application hodgepodge. It really does create a lot of confusion. And then when you add on top of it things like municipal bylaws, which may or may not have been aligned or reconciled with the standards that have been created, there are just so many different elements that create really a wildly different set of results in every building and space that we create right now. That's not good for accessibility outcomes, as one of the most important things for successful inclusion is consistent and predictable design. And it's the most common complaint I hear from the industry. Architects, interior designers, even contractors are all telling me they really wish Everything was just in the building code. Mm. And why isn't it? That's confusing. And the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal and human rights tribunals across Canada have already ruled in their courts that meeting the accessibility requirements, the minimum requirements defined in legislation, even in the AODA in Ontario, where they have more progressive standards, is not sufficient to meet the human rights standards to not discriminate against people with disabilities.
So staying in that vein and thinking about human rights, what does it mean for builders, developers, redevelopers to be thinking beyond accessibility code requirements?
Well, it really comes down to liability, doesn't it? Because if the human rights code tribunal is saying that following minimum codes in the building code is not sufficient, and understanding that the human rights code supersedes or is the higher law to any provincial legislation or even the Accessible Canada Act or the National Building Code, it really does push us to think about what do we need to be doing beyond code minimums. It also makes us think about how the human rights code enforced through the tribunals. What is the specific requirements? Everybody's guessing. So, for example, in the BC, there was a case in the tribunal in British Columbia where a BC condo was refusing to do upgrades for accessibility, and they were fined. The city of Victoria put in new bike lanes and unfortunately hadn't considered accessibility, and they were fined and being now forced to undo those mistakes. So it really is an important part of thinking about how do I get there, but I mean, companies like Designable Environments, and there are many great companies in Canada that do this work, help our clients to try to search for that answer. But it really does mean looking beyond minimums. The standards that people have developed have been a big, important help in that.
Mm. The City of Toronto recently mandated the Toronto Accessibility Design Guideline 2021 for all new developments and renovations. What are the potential positive outcomes of this?
Right. So again, I can provide a link. I don't think it's up on the City of Toronto site. So if you go look at the City of Toronto site right now, what you'd find is their 2004 set of standards, not the 2021. So I'll make sure that's again available on social media.
There seem to be 17 years missing there.
Yes, there are. It's surprising actually how hard it is to update a set of standards. There's a real difficulty. And there's one camp of people who really understand accessibility needs to be evidence-based design. It needs to be based on research. It needs to be based on consultation with people with disabilities. And many standards were done like that when I started my career 20 years ago. But there's been a pushback with the changes to the building codes and additions of provincial legislation. There's a growing number of people who don't understand what's missing and think, we've done enough. We shouldn't have to do this. But the City of Toronto still is based on that evidence-based design thinking, thank goodness. So they have a very comprehensive set of standards beyond the typical sort of things that you might think about, including things, exterior things like accessible parks, spectator areas, play spaces, eating and picnic, public pools and spas, dog off-leash areas, service animal areas, water parks and waterfronts, and even campgrounds. And for specialized facilities, even, they've got accessibility requirements for arenas and recreational facilities, libraries, exhibition museum and galleries, childcare, emergency care, even courtrooms. So it's a really great resource if you're looking for something. It's very differently organized than most of the other standards, which, again, adds some confusion, but definitely a resource worth checking out.
Speaking of resources, you sent me a bunch of research on how several cities across the country have developed their own standards, places like Calgary, Winnipeg, Kingston, Windsor, Halifax. We'd be here all day if we tried to break them all down. But is there something in particular that you want to highlight or that jumps out as you look at all these different standards?
Well, I think one of the things that most people don't consider is they're not asking kind of questions like, who defines what accessibility is? And this was actually an article, a question that was written in an article by Dustin Godfrey from the Burnaby Beacon this past summer, for which I was interviewed. He interviewed a bunch of other people, and it was a very thought-provoking question. Who are the gatekeepers of accessibility? How are standards created? And who's involved? Or perhaps more importantly, who's not involved? And how transparent is the decision-making process about what gets in and what doesn't get in? in most cases, the content, because Designable Environments has been helping clients with these, creating these standards for over 20 years now. And we've seen that most of these standards are created with a committee and they're done behind closed doors. So there's no tracking about what was even considered to be included, who decided what, or why certain elements were decided not to be rejected either in whole or being put on hold until maybe the next revision. So there's a lot of things that are happening. In Ontario, we actually have kind of a war happening between the evidence-based design standards that are out there, particularly in municipalities and corporations and organizations. And then the other side of it were the people who are pushing back saying, no, we don't need to have such extensive standards. We need to, and again, I'm using air quotes, be reasonable, because these people often don't really understand the gap created from the human rights perspective.
Thea, there are a couple of events related to this coming up over the course of the next few months. What's coming down the pipeline that you want to put on our radar?
Well, actually, I only wanted to mention one thing because there are so many things coming up next year, but we have so many more shows. So I just wanted to quickly put onto people's radar at the end of January, on January 29th, the World Disability and Rehabilitation Conference is taking place this year in Montreal and Quebec. So again, I'll be providing that on social media for everybody.
Thea, where can people find you on social media? I'm going to retweet you. They know they can find me at Dave Brown Radio, but where can they find you?
Okay, there's lots of places to find me. I'm on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. On Twitter, you can find me at TKURDI. But if you look me up on LinkedIn, my policy is there's no bad questions. And because LinkedIn doesn't limit how many characters I can use, I give fuller answers there. So Instagram I don't use as much because I can't provide links. And I love to give people lots of help.
Very, very good. Hey, Thea, this is the last time we're talking to you before 2022. Have a lovely holiday season, and we'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
Very happy holiday season, and may everybody have a joyful, accessible holiday, and I'll see you next year.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.